Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the Dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote backroads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution. Hello, welcome and Happy New Year! It does feel a bit late, but this is my first No Heathen Land of 2023. This is Season 2, Episode 4, and I'm going to jump straight into this episode because it's a long one, but I'm really excited to share this with you. My guests are artist Bunty Mae Marshall and her partner George Parr. Together, they've recently collaborated in making the instant hit zine What. It's really excellent. And I urge you to seek it out if you don't know it already. In this chat, which was recorded in November 2022, Bunty and George tell me about their experience in visiting the derelict mansion site on Milner's Field in Saltaire. It's fascinating. And we also have a really interesting discussion about the resurgence of folklore and tradition in recent years. So I really hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording this episode. Here we go. Okay, hi. Bunty and George, who I'm with today, and we've got a really exciting story on No Heathen Land. So I just wanted you to introduce yourselves, if that's okay. So I'll start with Bunty.
Yeah, hi, I'm Bunty. I co-write and illustrate Hwat magazine with my partner George, who is sat in our library as we speak, and I guess I've kind of been interested in the spooky happenings and goings on for a really long time, and we've kind of delved into a few that kind of, some of that kind of stuff within the zine as well.
Yeah. Should also say that Bunty is an amazing artist in her own right as well.
Thank you.
And obviously, in the notes of this podcast, we will link everything that you do. So
thank you.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, and I'm George. Just the other half of Team Hwat, basically. And yeah, always excited to talk about spooky stuff.
Yeah, so I think it'd be really fun to start with your zine, Hwat. So it's only just started, and I think that it's been like a pretty instant success, as far as zines go anyway. It's been amazing, and I came to your launch. So you've just put out issue 2. So do you want to sort of say like why you started making the zine and where the name comes from as well, because that's quite cool.
Yeah.
And sort of like what your intention is for going forward with the zine.
Okay, so me and George first kind of got in contact. He was working on a zine called Astral Noise, which is sort of a music journalism zine, kind of looking at heavy metal, basically. And I think you wanted to kind of do a bit of a segue off that, didn't you? Well, and start doing some zines about your interests in folklore and things.
Yeah, I started doing like one-off sort of special zines there. So I did one on like the Soulsborne series of games, and then I did one on Tolkien, and then I wanted to do one on folklore, and it just kept like growing and growing, and then it was going to become like a series, and then it was like it just doesn't make sense to be under a, you know, existing title anymore. So we just made it our own thing because I'd got Bunty involved by that point.
Yeah, I kind of asked me if I could illustrate a piece on the TV show Detectorists.
Mm-hmm. Which I love too.
Yeah, it's a great show. Anyone who's listening, please watch it. I cannot urge you more.
There's a new special coming up.
Yeah, a new special coming up at Christmas. So, yeah. Well, yeah, George asked me to illustrate a piece for what was going to be his zine. And I did that, and kind of time passed by. It kind of sat on the, he didn't really do anything with it for a while because a lot of the other things going on with Astral Noise. And then when we sort of became a couple, we decided that we'd kind of funnel all of our interest in like history and old ruins and folklore and myths and legends into one sort of umbrella publication.
Basically,
which
started like all the pieces that I'd coalesced that were just like I was trying to fit into one piece, to split them up into like themes. So we did the first one as folklore and folk horror, and the second one, obviously, it's just come out as myths and legends.
Mm-hmm. I read it. It's great.
Thank you.
And then yeah, we've got more, like, well, loads more that we want to do, some that we've already got more pieces for as well. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, so we kind of wanted to kind of come at this whole thing with quite a vague, relatively vague sort of viewpoint, in that we didn't want to sort of commit to one specific subject. We wanted to be able to look at a lot of different subjects with the same eye. So we kind of had our tagline, if you call it that, is ancient lore for modern folks. So mm-hmm. it's that sort of kind of a very brief way of saying that we wanted to look at old stories, histories, folklore, legends, like geographical mm-hmm. sites, but through the lens of the modern day and how they speak to us now, how these stories speak to us, how these ancient sites speak to us. Through lots of different things, through, you know, a lot of modern media, cinema, music, and film as well. That's always been
like modern folklore as well. Like, yeah, the whole thing is just how things that survive for a long time. Like, looking at how those things get reinterpreted and reimagined, and how what that tells you about like different times in history, and then also like now. So, like the way that we look at different. Like, well, I mean, the new issue, for example, will be like looking at ancient mythology, like a lot of it's ancient mythology, but looking at like what it means to us now. So reimagining stories of different characters in myth and things like that. And that's where the idea for the name comes from as well, really. Cause,
yeah. So Hwat is the first word in several epic poems, but notably Beowulf,
mm-hmm.
Which is an old sort of Norse saga tale, I guess. But Hwat is in old English, and it means like hark, like listen.
That's where it's usually interpreted
kind of
as.
There's
still loads of conjecture, but that's part of the interesting thing is because it's still open to interpretation, everyone interprets it differently. And the thing that spiralled it was picking up Maria Devana Headley's translation of Beowulf, which is like dubbed as like a feminist translation because she actively tries to like breathe life into the female characters who are often like been overlooked by men translating it, and so she chooses to interpret Hwat just as bro, like, because she thinks of that as like it's a way that a man might start a story that they're telling other men, I guess, basically. And yeah, that starts the whole debate. Like a lot of people get annoyed when people change things, but you know, people forget that when you're translating a text in a language that's dead, that is no longer used, you have to make decisions, because you have to decide whether you're going to keep the original flow of it and make it poetic and make it the same rhythm, or whether to just interpret it as directly as you think you can, and then turn, basically it's going to become like a weird broken prose, or whether to sort of break it down to the story elements and try and hit the same story beats, and like all these different ways of words that we haven't even fully agreed on the meaning of. You have to decide what you think that means. So essentially, when you're translating, you're in a way rewriting, because you have to make all these decisions. So you can't do it without putting something of yourself into it.
So is it Seamus Heaney's his opening? He translates it as "so."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His uncle would. That's how his uncle would start storytelling. Uh-huh. So he's kind of put his very personal spin on it, whereas anyone who didn't know that backstory would just read that as a translation of Huat. Mm-hmm. So I guess with the name Huat, we kind of liked it, because it was you know, it has an exclamation point as standard in kind of, you know, regards to what it means. So it's kind of a call to arms. I don't know. It's a very sort of punchy. We liked the name, and we also kind of thought it was kind of funny that no one would necessarily know how to say it.
Yeah.
So it would be a talking point, but it encapsulates what we're trying to do, I guess. The idea of reimagining old ideas, old stories, old, you know, literature.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, it's perfect. And I liked what you said about sort of reinterpreting and revisiting old stories and putting your own spin on it, and I think your writing and your artwork and some of your writing as well is like perfectly matched for that too. Yeah, I've really enjoyed the first two zines. I look forward to great guests as well, great guest writers and artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've managed to tap into a lot of incredible writers and amazing artists. I think
people we're interviewing as well, like we're sitting on some really good stuff that's like really frustrating, but
we can't release it yet.
Yeah.
Like, how exciting.
The next issue, something very exciting is coming up in that one. Which the issue itself will be on, the only spoiler you'll get this evening is it will be on ancient stones, which is something that me and George kind of bonded over from the get-go when we first got to know each other. And we've both been interested in visiting and sort of learning about ancient stones and monuments for a long, long time. So this one is going to be quite a personal one, I think, isn't it? It's going to be a lot of, well, they all are really, but yeah. I'm really looking forward to the next one.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Hopefully that'll be out in maybe sort of the first sort of quarter of next year.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. So I think we'll get into your story and then we might circle back at the end. There's a couple of things I wanted to ask about the scene in particular. Cool. So one of the nice things about you guys and your Instagram, which is great, and obviously the zine itself, is that you do like, you go out into the field and you you find the stuff out and then you write about it. And this story is exactly that. So you can start the story if you like.
Yeah, no, it's we'd like to use Instagram because we wanted to make a physical product, but we like to use Instagram just because it's a good way to connect with people, you know, everywhere. So, yeah, we posted pictures from Milner Field, didn't we? So we went... in the woods outside, sort of between Saltaire and Bingley, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm still learning the area, but yeah.
Recently moved up to the north.
Yes, yeah.
Just
yeah.
getting
like,
to grips.
Literally like a week ago, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, about a week. Thank you. Honorary northerner now.
Yeah.
So we did it. We went to Bingley on the train and walked essentially through the woods to Saltaire. And you can do that walk. Once you get to the woods, it's a really nice walk. You can do that walk just, you know, without thinking much of it. It's especially nice if you start on the Saltaire side, because Saltaire is a very like pretty village, and we'll get into that, I'm sure. But you go through the park and you go up and sort of through a little bit more of a sort of suburby area and eventually hit this sort of like wide path, and you wouldn't really think much of it, but it's the reason it's so wide is that it used to be like the old coach road. The coach would go up to an old manor, and the old manor was Milnerfield Manor. And if you walk through if you take the main path through the woods, you'll just come out the other side in Bingley. But if you look, well, you can't see it from the path, but if you leave the path and go off to the left into the trees, from the sort of from the trees and the bracken and everything, basically big heaps of rubble start emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And the first bit we found was some old the floor of some old stables, and then when we found the main bulk of the manor, we actually like came across some steps, so it was actually like we were like walking down to the manor. But the whole site's been just reclaimed completely by nature.
It was funny actually, when we first entered from the Bingley side, not from the Saltaire side, so that coachway wasn't kind of obvious to us. We hadn't got to that point yet, so when we first sort of found a few piles of rubble, we were like, oh, we found Milner Field, we found it. And we just could not work out where the rest of it was, because we'd seen online that a lot of other people who'd kind of sought out these ruins had found the sort of the orangery tiles and a lot of like big epic stonework, and we'd found some, and we were there for about an hour and a half,
yeah, we
like,
were just like
walking around in circles,
it.
Like where is
it's funny because when you find it, it's so big and obvious, and just like it was like just, but it's because when you're in woodland, you know, things are just obscured.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we'd done a little bit of research beforehand on it, but did a lot more afterwards, and basically uncovered the whole story of the house. And it's tied in with the history of Saltaire, and it's quite interesting because so I've written a piece about it that's going to be in the new issue of Fantôme Scene, and it's which is like a ghost scene.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know it, and yeah, it's interesting because Saltaire is a very pretty village. It's a like a UNESCO World Heritage site now. Mm-hmm. As well, quite popular with tourists, and It was, the whole village was built essentially to house the workforce of Salt's Mill, which was set up by Sir Titus Salt, and he was known for being, for his day, quite a philanthropist, and the town was particularly picturesque, and it had all sorts of sort of amenities and things that a lot of places in that time wouldn't have. So whilst a lot of workers in the area, in very nearby and Bradford and Leeds and stuff, would have been living in essentially slums, he housed his workforce all in these, you know, quaint houses and
like beautiful stonework, gorgeous,
yeah,
masonry,
and there was wash houses and recreational places they could go, and you know, a beautiful new church and things like that. All these sort of things to try. The idea was to try and have a happy workforce, I suppose, which people in those days mainly didn't really think about, and he did. I mean, he's still, you know, he's still profiting off their labour, obviously, but for his day, he's better than a lot of rich people. And essentially, he bought some land just outside of Saltaire, which was going to be the house for his son, Titus Salt Jr. There's some reference to there being a building there beforehand, but
the old Milnerfield.
Yeah,
old,
I don't really know a lot about it. There may be some more research we can do on that, but I didn't find a lot. And essentially, they Titus Salt Jr. pulled that down and built a new house from scratch. And that was in the 1870s. And yeah, it looks like, if you see old pictures of it, old illustrations of it, it looks so different from Saltaire. Saltaire is very pretty, quite how would you describe the building work there?
It's like classic Victorian, but Victorian architecture, but it's very, you know, it's not like commandeering, it's, you know, all the houses are very small.
Yeah.
And very uniform, and and yeah, it's not, it doesn't look powerful.
Yeah, I mean, you can go now and it still looks the same.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. I mean, a bunch of my friends live in the mill workers' houses. Like, they're absolutely gorgeous. They're very small, but they're beautiful. But they're
it's just quite like the architecture's a bit more like florid and it's just pretty essentially. Yeah. Whereas you see illustrations and pictures of Milnerfield Manor, which is obviously what the house is called, and it's just like a big imposing Gothic. It's like if you wanted to build a quintessential like haunted house, you would build this.
Even before its downfall, it looked like a haunted house.
After you told me about it, obviously I've had a look, and it is like trying to imagine it. But then seeing it, you're like, it's so big.
Mm. It's unreal. Like, we couldn't believe when we were actually like, we found the ruins in there in its like entirety. We were like, this is the whole forest. Like, we thought that we'd found it. We're like, oh, this place is big the first time. But that was just the stables. Like, that, and we thought that was the whole manor. But yeah, it's absolutely, you can't even get your head around it. I mean, you guess you go and see big old manor houses these days, and you can. But when you think of them as in ruins, you can't. Your brain doesn't fill in the gaps. You can't comprehend.
Yeah. But the rubble you find as well is like these huge chunks, and you realise it was really like properly built to last. And a lot of the manors sort of built in that era were did fall into disrepair and were torn down to make way for new buildings and things because they just weren't sustainable because they were all susceptible to damp and you know you couldn't heat them, you couldn't light them, but nothing's ever been done with this site, there were no plans to ever do anything with the site that we can find reference to. So the only reason that it seems it was torn down, partly health and safety concerns, but mainly just it had a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially that's all based on what happened once it was finished being built. So Titus Salt Jr. ended up living there for 14 years.
So that was from the 1870s, did you say?
Yes.
Like, so early 1870s.
And it was, it lived up to its billing for a while, I suppose. It was, a landmark in the area. It had, now it's all hemmed in by trees, but it supposedly had a nice, beautiful view of down into the valley where Saltaire is housed. He hosted members of the royal family there twice. Whilst living there, the family business sort of started to struggle for the first time. And despite seeming perfectly healthy, he collapsed on the floor of the billiards room with heart failure.
I think he was in the house for 14 years at that point.
Yeah.
Just completely out of the blue. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's like reports of the people who saw him earlier that day and things like that. The house moved on in 1903 to Sir James Roberts, who essentially it became the house that whoever was managing director of Salt's Mill, whoever took over the company, sort of became the usually moved into this house. So it was Sir James Roberts, who became managing director. Whilst living there, he'd already lost one son before moving in, but whilst living there, his son, I think it was on holiday, his son drowned whilst fishing. His older son then died at 36 of some illness, I can't remember what, and then his last living son was very badly wounded in World War One. He had to sort of relinquish control of the company because he was reliant on help from his sons, and obviously they couldn't help anymore. And there was also a family scandal involving his daughter, who had eloped with someone who they didn't think was a match, and then the man she eloped with killed someone else who she was apparently having an affair with. So there was all this family scandal going on. After all of this, Roberts and his wife moved out, and they died quite soon after in Hastings. that's still probably the happiest occupant in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Starts well and goes down from there.
Yeah.
Starts with a heart attack in the billiard room.
Yeah.
Which we actually stood in the billiard room. Yeah. Like you can stand there and it's like it's eerie.
You can find maps like the original blueprints of the house, and you can stand in certain spots. So you can stand on a bit you can see is a sort of hallway. And to the right is the billiards room, as you say, and there's like a big metal beam that's sort of fallen down over the top of it. And you can look down and see this bit would have been, that would have been the orangery. And then at the end, you've got the conservatory, which is massive. And there's these like tiled mosaics on the floor that you can still see. And there was a picture that was taken in the house from that hallway looking down towards the conservatory. And you can sort of stand and line up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of, it's interesting because you can even sort of, in some of those old pictures, you can even see where like there's a tree that's still there, but obviously all the other trees have then sort of like populated the whole area. It's interesting. But yeah, by that point essentially, it already had a reputation and the house already proved really hard to sell. But eventually Ernest Gates moved in. Again, he was the new director at the mill. Within less than a year of moving in, his wife died, and she was quite sickly anyway, I believe. She died, I think, in the house, and then 18 months later he died of septicemia. And then the final occupant was Arthur Remington Hollins, again the new director at the mill.
You think people would just kind of,
yeah,
maybe sort of, I'll move in down the road.
Get a new house, yeah.
Get one of the mill workers to move in.
But his wife caught pneumonia living there, potentially because of damp in the house. So you could say the house itself, you know, was by this point. he died at 51. He didn't die in the house, but I believe he was still, you know, resident there, and it died in like the most uncomfortable way I've ever heard of, which is that he had a sudden irritation of the gallbladder, liver, and diaphragm, and he literally hiccuped to death.
Grim.
It's like bad enough just having an annoying hiccup.
That's like the most uncomfortable way I could imagine to, you know.
But also kind of a little bit hilarious. Do you know what I mean? Like,
definitely fit in with the like
too soon.
Yeah, it's too soon. with like the drama of the house. So when was the last occupant?
I'm not 100% sure actually.
I think it was late. I think it was early 1930s maybe.
Yeah, I think you're roughly right. Yeah,
before the Second World War.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, before the Second World War.
Yeah, because actually when the Second World War was occurring, they actually used the abandoned site for grenade training.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's what a bizarre end to a house that was built completely from love. And like Titus Salt Jr., when the house was built, like every single aspect of the house was so carefully considered. And you know, he made a lot of the fixtures and the fittings himself, like in a workshop that he'd built on the land, you know, wood turned, you know, doorknobs and ceiling roses and stuff. And to think that after this horrible history of deaths, and then the army swoop in and start using the site as for grenade training, a bizarre end.
Yeah, it got stripped for parts a lot as well, so like by this point it was still standing but basically didn't have a roof, and they just needed materials,
I guess, for the war effort
anything of value was obviously stripped out of it.
Yeah.
But it seemed to become a sort of like place that people would visit sometime afterwards. So there's a report from somebody from Bradford called Trevor Meek, who said that he visited it and that he was exploring the house, and that a sudden darkness overcame him, and he found himself just like randomly falling back into the cellar as if he was being like pulled into the cellar. And then in 1951, a 15-year-old called Anthony Davis said he saw an apparition carrying a flute and wearing Edwardian clothes in the house. And he said it went up to a mirror, but that its reflection wasn't, you couldn't see its reflection in the mirror. And then apparently the apparition and the mirror both disappeared.
Oh.
And there is some evidence, people who went to to verify afterwards, said that they found evidence that there would have been a mirror hung there. Not that you couldn't have figured that out, because there presumably was like a mark, but still.
And this schoolboy was like, he had a reputation for being a very matter-of-fact, normal child with, you know, no particularly vivid imagination. Like, he was taken very seriously by the adults who surrounded him, so coming up with this story would have been very out of character for him if it hadn't been true. So.
So that man that he saw is now known as the Green Man of Milner Field, and it's like kind of the resident ghost, one of the most famous ones anyway, that you're supposed to see there. But we actually picked up a book on the house, which is written by Richard Lee Vanderdale, is that it? And R. David Beale, and they when they're right, it's quite matter of fact. It's quite just sort of like, you know, the house was built then, and then it's a history book essentially. But they talk about the, you know, the sort of supernatural things attached to it as well, the grisly reputation, I suppose, of the house. And they say while they went there to sort of survey the site and find out, you know, get more information, do more research, they turned their back for a second, and they were using a tape measure to plan out the sort of foundations of the house that are still there. And then turned around, and the tape measure was, how high did they say, like
12 feet?
Like 12 feet in the air, like hanging in a branch from a nearby tree, and they just couldn't think of a single way that it could have ended up there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, I like that, because it's kind of playful. Like if I was a ghost, that's what I'd do.
And it's kind of like something that
clamber up a tree and find a tape measure.
Yeah, it's kind of like something that, I mean, even for like a skeptic, like what a weird thing to make up. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Strange.
So it's a really like interesting site to visit. It's definitely like a weird sort of aura. I know that
there's like a somber feel when you're walking around, and
it's very quiet, and the canopy and the trees there are quite high, so there is this sense of like feeling like you're being watched. I know a lot of it is mental, obviously, but psychological, but it definitely adds to the atmosphere. And you can walk and sort of plot out some of the rooms, and you can see these big piles of rubble, and you can see in some places, like one of the ones that people often take a picture of when they go and see there, is the bricks that say Cliff on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was there was like a company nearby,
a local brickwork company
run by
the Cliff family, the Cliff family.
Mm-hmm. And you can see the brickwork of the ovens in kitchens as well,
and get into the basements, which is,
and yeah, there's
biblical spiders down there.
Yeah, there's different spots where you can see sort of like black, you know, little caverns essentially, and it's like they're filled with rubble, and you can kind of just peer down a little bit. But there's a particular opening where you can just, if you just crouch down, you can get into the cellar, and walk around on top of the piles of rubble, and you can't get too far in, but you're sort of then in the only sort of, I guess, surviving part of the house. But it's, yeah, the site is just like overrun with spiders. It's like just as creepy as you can get.
Like sacks hanging from the ceiling,
big spiders.
You like proper hanging. Freaked out when you saw them.
Because I went in a few yards and I just immediately looked up and was like, yeah, they're just hanging over your head. It's quite terrifying.
So they've taken over the site.
Yeah.
Now the spiders.
Yeah, now the spiders. The spiders.
You see them on top, like on top as well. There are like webs around and stuff, but underneath, they've just really made it their own.
You went in the you visited in the summer, didn't you? And it was
It was a really nice day actually. But what was weird is that as soon as you get in there, like everything's dark because you're in the you're in
a very
the
thick canopy. On the...
Yeah, but the day itself was like gorgeous day, wasn't it? We were just walking around in t-shirts, and then
quite.
And then it just got really gloomy, and it was quite eerie how quickly the weather changed.
It was, and then it very quickly became very sunny again after we left. I remember going, we went walked because we did bing, went from Bingley to Saltaire. We went into Saltaire and you sort of enter the park there, and it's very picturesque still. And there was, you know, people running around, kids playing, people walking their dogs, all sorts. It was just quite a picturesque scene. And it's quite a weird thing, because you think of this place which is so picturesque and bright and lovely, and it's, you know, it's a place people visit, and
then just down the road,
yeah, you kind of think of it as like it's mad that there's a place that seems so sort of picture perfect, but it's kind of like hiding it's, you know, dark aspects in the woods just nearby, I guess.
Yeah, because it's not talked about,
yeah,
in any of the books about Saltaire. It's so just brushed weird. Over. So we have this book, this book on Milner Field, written by this pair of chaps, but they're the only people who have written a book about it, and it's fascinating. Like, it's absolutely fascinating, and there isn't even really any articles, or I mean, there's a couple, and people have gone to see it, but like, it's kind of been swept under the carpet a little bit.
Yeah, it only really gets picked up by people who go and find it, and like, it got a very small sort of coverage in like local press when some people first found the way into the cellar and things like that.
But it's not been cornered off. It's not been completely. They couldn't demolish it. They tried to demolish it with dynamite, and it wouldn't come down. So they had to take it apart brick by brick. Like they really, no one would buy it. Like, it was just sat there in the woods, this insanely beautiful and like haunting building, just sat there, and they had to take it apart brick by brick because it was just redundant. And it's just nuts that the site hasn't been used for anything else. Like, they haven't fully cleared it. It wouldn't, you know, I mean, Saltaire's quite a wealthy area, but they have, it's not cornered off. Like, you kids can go and climb in the cellars even now. Like, all these places normally have been locked down, and you can't, you know, bricked up, and you can't get into them anymore. I went through a phase a few years ago. I've been really into like breaking into places I shouldn't have been, and you know, old abandoned, you know, what do you call it? Urban exploring. Urbexing. Me and my brother called it FedExing. We hated the term urbexing, so we called it FedExing. But most places that you could do that with 10 years ago, you can't now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, health and safety have ramped up quite a lot over the past 10 years. I think people are just more wary. Kids are more sort of, like, I don't know, find things out on the internet and then want to go and explore with their friends and stuff. But yeah, you can just go there. It's nuts. Like, but also no one talks about it, but it's still there. Yeah. It's like, we were there, like, maybe there was like two other people there that we saw.
Well, yeah, and they weren't even coming to visit. They just walked past.
Mm-hmm. And it's just...
Yeah.
And then you walk, you know, 400 yards down the road, and you've got this, you know, is it Robertson Park? I forgot his name.
It might be Roberts Park, I think.
That's it. Yeah. And it's just like absolutely abundant with kids and people playing frisbees and dogs and
quaint little cafe and all that.
It's just it is like a Scooby Doo episode. You know, it really is. You know, you kind of, you know, hop in the what's their van called?
Mystery Machine.
That's it. I was going to say Micro Machine, but that would be too small.
That wouldn't make sense.
It wouldn't.
And also, my memory is awful. But yeah, it is. It's very rare to be able to find these ghost stories in the wild, like actually go to these places instead of just finding out about them from books and from the internet and stuff. Like, so, you know, I would, with caution, urge people to seek it out if they're interested in the history, and as long as you don't take anything from there. We noticed that a couple of the things that we'd seen other people take photos of, artifacts and stuff, are still there. Like, no one wants to steal a haunted brick because you might die.
I guess you there's a part of you, even if you're quite... think of yourself as quite rational, there's a part of you that just thinks like,
but if I
what did? If I bring the curse back with me?
I think I definitely feel that way. Like, I'm like a little bit superstitious-y, but not really, fairly logical, but still I'd be like, oh, that's but I love the idea of going somewhere when you can like feel the place.
You totally can. Like, we sat and had lunch there, and it was very weird. Like, it didn't feel right. You should tell me these things. I was just hungry.
We
did spend like about an hour and a half just trying to find the ruins, because we were just in the wrong part of the woods. But So I was hungry by that point. But yeah, it did feel weird. And you kind of feel like when you're there, there's a certain level of respect that it requires. Because there is so much loss that's happened there. And, you know, you can look at it from a sort of, like, playful, there's ghost stories and that surround the area. But really, they were real people, and they died, lots of them, in quick succession.
Yeah.
All tied to this house. Like, you know, it is quite sad. And you can feel a sense of loss, I think. It's quite sort of... You kind of don't go there and skip around and... I mean, we did a bit of skipping, maybe, but you know what I mean. Like, well, maybe not. But I mean, you do, yeah. It's quite solemn.
No more skipping than usual, anyway.
Yeah, well, there we go.
Which is usually an
answer. Touché. Yeah.
But it's weird though, because the whole woods, you can sort of see the whole sort of, I don't know the right word, like the estate. I guess, like, obviously the gardens and
300 acres, it was huge,
bigger like than the just the house. And there are a couple of, there's like is it like the South Lodge and things like that. There's a couple of buildings that were sort of on the perimeters of the property that that are still there and are just houses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, so there's people living in these houses with windows that just look into this forest.
Oh.
with a haunted house in it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, yeah.
In this book that George mentioned that was written about the estate and the house, they actually have in here the sort of lot entry for when it went up for auction.
Oh, wow. So when is that from?
So this particular one is from the 1930s.
Okay.
This is when it went up for auction. This was kind of like when it didn't sell. And they've obviously really tried very hard to, like, sell the house. I mean, the pictures are just absolutely stunning of the interior. And even the way that they've laid out the, like, the listing, they really put in... They really tried to sell it, basically. So, like, the opening gambit, this is how it is described. So, the well-adapted, substantial residence known as Milner Field. Built upon a commanding eminence overlooking the beautiful valley of the River Aire, it is a self-contained and easily managed modern structure. Easily managed if you've got, like, 500 staff.
Yeah.
With a large conservatory, winter gardens, greenhouses, well-stocked gardens, commodious stables and garages, two entrances, lodges, woodlands, grass, lands, lake, etc. The position is ideal. Woodland, park, river, lake, moor and meadow enrich its situation, and extensive bracing moorlands are within a few minutes. The mansion, which occupies a commanding position overlooking Airedale, was erected from the plans of Mr. Norman Shaw. It possesses its own water supply, drawn from natural springs, its own filter beds, water-cooled dairies and storage rooms, hunter's stabling, including aromatic fodder hoist, good drains and electric lighting. The interior decorations of the mansion are carried out in a magnificent panelling of oak, teakwood, mahogany, chestnut and cedarwood. So, you know, it really was an incredible building.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they really have tried to sell it with this auction listing and it didn't sell.
Yeah, and I imagine probably the worst time ever to sell was just before the Second World War. And then after that, you know, you've got, like, no one's going to buy it after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Because the world completely changed, and society completely changed.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Houses like that weren't really viable anymore because, like I said earlier, people couldn't really afford the upkeep. But it's interesting because so many of those sites just got torn down and then something else was built there, or they just got left and then eventually something was done with them. But it's like they just tore it down just because they didn't want it there anymore and then just left it to...
Yeah, like, yeah, normally that you know, land, especially in the UK, land is valuable, really, really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, especially land that can be built on, that's previously been built on, has sort of buildings permissions and stuff, you know, it just was left.
It's not listed or anything, right?
I mean, I don't think that the listings thing came in until a lot later. I think that it didn't have chance to be listed. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, I might be wrong with that, but I think it was It didn't survive long enough to become a listed building, mm-hmm. basically. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been able to be torn down, unless, I don't know, you don't know. I don't know what conversations happened at the time.
I think the space could be listed, but maybe. It's probably not, because then it would be protected.
So. Yeah. Mm. It's just nuts that nothing's been done with it. Like, mm-hmm. it baffles me that they haven't... I mean, I'm pleased that they haven't cordoned it off of, you know, railings and whatnot, but it surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as it is genuinely quite a dangerous site. And, you know, it's quite cool, though, and you walk around and you see all the old masonry. Mm-hmm. You can see, like, the kind of the arches and the belfry tower. Yeah, you can see it all. You can match up from the old photographs of the building where that stone used to be. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a lot of them. I took quite a lot of photos of the makers, like the mason's marks on the stones. Mm. All of them were different. Like, so many people worked on this building, and it's just there in ruins.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go and visit when it's less spooky weather.
Yeah.
We only have about 3 hours of light at the moment.
I'm the kind of person that will go there specifically when there's spooky weather, though. Yeah. Probably end up breaking my ankle.
It feels like visiting... it's like visiting the house in Haunting of Hill House after it's been torn down. That's what it feels like.
Mm.
Yeah.
We didn't really know the extent of the history either at the time. Yeah. Like, I'd heard from a friend that this place existed, Drew Millwood.
Mm-hmm.
He lives quite close by, and he's really interested in that kind of thing. He mentioned it, and I was like, gotta go. I've absolutely got to go, isn't mm-hmm. it? You know, it's on our doorstep and it's still accessible. And but then doing the research into it, we were like, holy shit, this this is dark. Like, it really is. And that's what kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find a lot of stuff, so that book was a bit of a godsend. I actually ordered it from Salt's Mill. So they do
they do have
sell it
there.
But I like work in Salt's Mill now, and I've been in that bookshop and didn't see it. So
at least you're not the managing director of Salt's Mill.
Yeah, no.
It is quite a weird kind of turn of events that you now work in the mill after, you know, doing all this research.
I have thought, like...
Not as a mill worker, can we just add? Yeah. He hasn't gone back in time.
It's offices now, yeah. I have tried to work out whether I could get as far as the house on my lunch break and be able to get back again. I think it's probably a bit too far.
You could probably jog.
If I was to go for a lunchtime jog, I could probably get there.
Take your skateboard, skate down the hill.
Yeah, but imagine that, if I could go there every day on my lunch break.
Yeah.
Just sit there, such a goth, going to sit in a bunch of haunted ruins and eat your sandwich and then come back to work.
Because of the train strikes, I had to get, last week I had to go in really early, and I basically had every morning like 50 minutes just walking around Solterre before everything opened.
Mm-hmm.
And one morning it was like really misty.
Yeah.
The canal was properly frozen, and I was just thinking, if I could get
just a little bit further
now, that would be insane.
Mm-hmm.
Get some sweet photos for the grid.
Yeah.
Yeah, every time it gets misty in Leeds, I'm like, I wake up and I'm like, where can I go? Where can I go take photos of a graveyard? Is there any graveyards nearby? Is there any old stones? So, like, you can try and make the most of that while you're living in Solterre. We're working in Solterre, sorry.
Yeah. It's a really amazing story. Thank you so much. So just to come back round to what you were talking about the zine. I think I've asked this to a couple of guests before, but there seems to have been a sort of, I think we might have talked about this before, a bit of a resurgence in like folklore and like, I guess, local history and that kind of thing and interest in it. Have you got any theories as to why that might be?
Yeah, we have. We kind of wrote about it in the intro to our first issue. Because it's very obvious to us that there's like a renaissance of interest in that kind of stuff, and everything surrounding it, you know, witchcraft, magic, demonology, all of that stuff. I mean, it's always been interesting to people, but even more so now, especially when it's tied in with history. So, George, you talk a bit about that.
Well, it's happened in the past as well. Like, a lot of the stuff we have obviously was recorded by different people, like the surviving folklore that we have, tales that were recorded by folklorists and stuff. And a lot of the stuff we have on old stones and things was recorded by people in the Victorian era. And yeah, there's like every so often there's this sort of resurgence in stuff. It comes back a bit differently each time, but I generally think it comes from like two places. So one of them is the fact that following some point between the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution, I think people feel like they lost the connection with nature, and now nature is like something that we visit. It's like something you kind of go, like you forget that, you know, it's all a bit sort of it sounds pretentious to talk about it in that way now, to say we are nature, but it's like it's true, you know. You forget that when you look at something like a natural scene and you think it looks, you know, really beautiful and stunning and beyond anything you can comprehend, like you, it's just as natural as you are. You have that in you in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But we also now think of nature as a sort of commodity, like you go and you sort of extract that natural beauty and that fresh air and then you go back to the city or whatever. Where people used to live and work in the countryside and they were attuned to the cycle of the seasons, and especially in the past that would have been life or death, you know. And that's why so much old religion and mythology is based around the sun, because they needed the sun to come back every year and they needed the reassurance that it would, and they needed the reassurance that, you know, they'd have the harvest period and that they'd have everything happen as it should, so that they can continue to create, you know, create the food they need and things like that. And that's why a lot of folk horror is based on the idea of the seasons getting stuck and not turning as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so a lot of it comes from that disconnect with nature that I think often stems from periods where that feels particularly relevant, and now that feels relevant in a very particular way with climate change, where it feels like we're not just like not part of nature anymore, but we're like actually destroying it. And it, you know, you want to have a relationship with it that's, people want to have a relationship with it that feels like it's like based on respect and like nurturing where we have, you know, caused damage. And then the other thing, the other aspect of it is kind of political. Like it comes as a reaction to, it's like kind of tied in with the idea of like heritage in a way. I mean, a lot of it's like, Tom from Green Lung spoke about this a lot in our first issue when we interviewed him, and mm-hmm. sort of said that a lot of it comes down to, in recent times, that would be political upheavals like Brexit, and in America it would be like the Trump presidency and things like that, where people were looking for this sense of identity that's not tied in with what today represents, whether it's capitalism and xenophobia and
mm-hmm.
just right-wing governments, or
just a whole lot more
or austerity, things like that, things that have like defined politics in recent years. People are trying to find something that connects them to the land in which they live, but doesn't feel harmful.
There's also, I think, a sense of like, in a weird way, looking back, because looking forward is quite uncertain. So looking back at something that has been around for hundreds of years, these stories, the folklore, you know, that exists in people's cities, people are interested in that because we don't really know what's going to happen in the future. Like, it's quite scary, and like George mentioned, you know, with climate change and everything, we don't know where that's all going. So looking back is kind of comforting in a way, and it pops up in so many things, so many successful films, and I mean, obviously even the folk horror. Like, even though it's horror, it's still looking back in a sort of, I don't know, it looks back as almost like everything was better then, you know. it's that whole notion that, you know, that people did things a bit, you know, they did things right back then, even though obviously they did a lot of things wrong too. But.
Yeah, that's what's interesting about it, because I was saying before about people previously being connected to the land, and you don't want to sort of romanticise it too much, because obviously life was hard, lifespans were shorter. In medieval period, a lot of it would have just been like serfs working for a landlord.
Yeah.
But it's that idea that like progress isn't linear. Like too often people assume that it is, and that things will just like get better and better, and that we'll get more and more rights, and we'll become more and more equal. And
we kind of are devolving.
But that doesn't really, it's not really the reality. So it's good to look back and see the things you did right and the things you did wrong.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you have to look back to see what you want the future to be, I guess.
And I think one last thing with regards to like the resurgence in this interest in like local history, myths, folklore, that kind of thing. I do think a lot of it comes out of the pandemic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as people were taken away from nature during a lot of, during the pandemic, especially when we weren't allowed to leave the house, which now kind of seems crazy that we're in a position where we had to, I had to like go on 10 kilometer runs just so I could see some trees, like, do you know what I mean? And that was my government approved exercise for the day. But so, a lot of people were stuck in their houses and were wanting to read about nature, read about stuff that they couldn't go out and see.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things cropped up, a lot of sort of interest in the zines cropped up around 2020.
Yeah,
zines in particular. Obviously, there's always been an interest in folklore. I mean, that goes without saying. But in our age range, it is unusual for people in their 20s and 30s to be so interested in old stories.
Yeah,
so that's what's happening now.
So my experiences, I've worked in local history for years, and I was always like the youngest person. I'm not that young.
Yeah.
So it's populated by a lot of older people, and I think there was a lot of gatekeeping going on, and I think this resurgence is just such a good thing, and it's sparked people's interest in like a renewed sense of heritage and how that's and how that shapes everything. They were great answers, thank you. I started this podcast last year in 2021 because I was like, I've got all these amazing contacts and I've got all this like experience and like weird knowledge like that's that, like, I don't really know what to do with it, so like, well, I'll use it for something.
Share
and then hopefully
it,
people will want to listen.
Yeah.
So yeah, I totally identify with that.
Well, I think, because are you working in, it's like you say, it was unusual for someone your age to work in local history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I'm a member of the Thoresby Society, the Leeds Historical Society, and as far as I'm aware, I'm one of the youngest members. I mean, I'm 36. In fact, our neighbour down in below us is a wonderful woman called Kay. She's 93. She's an archaeologist.
Still a working
archaeologist. Yeah. I drop shopping off for her every week. She loves a Waitrose fish pie. So I drop one off. I drop them off for her because she can't get to Waitrose. And when I put them out on her kitchen table, I have to like move these 2,000-year-old Roman pots out of the way that she's been rubbing the maker's marks off. And she's 93 and she's a member of the Thoresby Society, so it is kind of funny that there's up at the top of this building there's me and George who are really really interested in this stuff, and then in below us we've got Kay who's like nearly triple our age and she's interested in similar things, so it's really cool. It does span a lot of age ranges, but I do really like this resurgence in sort of the younger generation. And I say, I'm 36, I'm not necessarily that young, but, a lot of people who buy our zine, and I'm sure a lot of people who listen to your podcast, are in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in my 20s, I don't know.
I'm in my 20s.
Oh, it's good. Touché. I mean, when I was in my early 20s, I mean, that's what I mean. Like,
yeah,
15 years ago, there wasn't this. So,
yeah,
like,
there wasn't a lot of it.
It often spawns from, like, something that's, like, that is cool and is, like, part of culture. So
really music as well.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of, like, cool. I mean, the horror show exhibition kind of explored that in London recently. I went to, like there's been a lot of cool horror and folk horror in particular, and I think a lot of people's interest sparks in that because this stuff is a very like visual thing, and that harnesses it. But
so you get Ari Aster's films, and people are like, "Cool, yeah. This sort of culty,
the cult stuff."
Then they go, "What else is there to explore that follows these themes?" And so people like Ari Aster, and I mean, obviously there's plenty of other people who make films, and there's been plenty of films previous to that, but big blockbusters that have got people talking definitely have helped.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, but you get into it, and then before you start looking at the stuff behind it, and before you know it, you're a nerd.
Yeah, there we go.
We're all being nerds together. It's great.
We the nerds shall inherit the earth.
So just to end, I usually ask what kinds of things you've been enjoying. So I've remembered to think of a couple of things. So it could be like anything. So it's usually like music or a film or anything really.
Well, we've touched briefly on Detectorists.
Yeah,
we're huge fans of Detectorists, and as there's a Christmas special coming up on Boxing Day, which we're really excited about.
Are we watching too?
Yeah, it's like an hour and a half long one. So. Yeah, we're very excited about that.
Yeah, we've been getting into those kind of there's it's kind of like I've written a thing about this for there's a Detectorist scene called Waiting For You that you probably know. I've written something that's hopefully going to be in the next one. Which is about like Detectorists as it started off as being Detectorists as like anti-folk horror, but I kind of changed that because I didn't necessarily agree with it once I came to the end of that line of thinking, and basically came out with the idea that there's this sort of like alternative branching path. So folk horror is often very dark and stuff, and it often is, because of that, it's inherently a little bit cynical, and it often a lot of the films and books and stuff that are folk horror often end on quite a pessimistic note, and it's often just about, so if it is about like, you know, we've destroyed nature and incited its wrath and whatever, and it's fighting back or whatever, it often ends on the note of like, it's too late.
And everyone's dead.
But like, there's this, like Detectorists to me is kind of like,
it's like an antidote to that, really.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's something very quietly tuned into folklore and the kind of like magic of the landscape, but with a positive bent, and it's all about nurturing. And Mackenzie Crook's also done the
reimagining of Wurzel Gummidge.
Yeah, the recent sort of remake of Wurzel Gummidge, and that has a similar thing. It's obviously more aimed at children, but it's still very like magical.
A friend told me about this recently. I haven't watched it. They said it was good.
It's so good, and the music as well is by all scored by the Unthanks, who do the Magpie song from Detectorists.
Mm-hmm.
And we're huge Unthanks fans, and just to have that like threading through the whole of Wurzel Gummidge just kind of makes it so much more appealing to us.
Because it has the same like feel of folk horror in a way, like the imagery of a scarecrow
terrifying.
Coming to life.
They haunt my dreams.
And the music is very chilling and eerie, but it always ends on a positive note, and it's all about nurturing,
reconnecting,
and like the first episode is all about you know, the season is like stuck, like things aren't progressing, and the scarecrows need to come together and unlock the seasons.
But in the middle of the night, and they're terrifying.
And they're doing this,
and they're
like,
this weird
and
song and dance. Yeah. And I mean, come on, it's spooky.
Yeah, they create a kind of like crop circle thing doing it. It's really cool.
Yeah.
And I also spoke about This Country in that as well. I don't know if you've seen that, but
I've been watching it today actually while I've been working.
It's so good.
Yeah. Re-watching it.
Because there's an understated like folklore element to that as well. I know. Charlie Cooper's into that stuff because he's done like a podcast for Weird Walk and been in it and things. He's good.
The Fox Twins.
You've got the Fox Twins. That episode's almost like Blair Witch, like being lost in the woods.
Yeah. I always think it made me think of the Scarecrow episode where
Oh
my god,
like
the Scarecrow competition is so good.
Yeah, but instead of it being.
You see what they're doing, but it's not making me feel anything.
Yeah. But it's like instead of it being, you know, we're trying to make a sacrifice, it's just like some, you know, young adult who's still really childish, and he just has a tantrum because he's not won the local scarecrow competition.
Sets fire to the
yeah.
Oh, it's just yeah. But I think there's that sort of like pastoral
And it's very quietly political as well.
Yeah, because
it's all about
absolutely.
Like these forgotten areas and like
underfunded.
Yeah, these
rural
kids
areas.
Obviously got poor education and there's no job prospects for them, so they just sort of like float around getting up to mischief, and all the local programs have been cut, so the only like source of like any thing they have is their local vicar, and
they become like best friends but sort of almost enemies at the same time with him. And honestly, the vicar is like one of my favorite characters on TV. Like he's just great. I cried with that on that, like watching the end of that show. But yeah, I think because we watch a lot of horror, we mainly watch horror movies. I think
and at the end of This Country, I just wanted to say this before we moved on, they make her Lord of the Harvest, and she says they're taken over from Arthur,
given a shit since 19.
Yeah, it's like he's been Lord of the Harvest since like 19 whatever, but he hasn't quite frankly hasn't given a shit since 2003.
<That's> it. So yeah, it's fine. The whole like folklore thing runs through that show for sure, even if it's quite subtle. But yeah, I think we watch a lot of stuff that's TV shows that are light-hearted because we watch so many horror movies to sort of balance it out. So yeah, I mean, is there any horror series that we're watching?
No, I'm going to show you Midnight Mass because you didn't watch that.
I haven't watched that yet. I was talking to a friend about this the other day and she said, have you watched it? And I was like, I started it for some reason and then I didn't carry on, and I don't know why, so I need to go back and revisit it.
Yeah,
I think with me, you know, there's all everyone watched American Horror Story and all those.
Yeah,
I just wasn't interested.
I've only watched the first season.
Do you know what I think it is? And I've only just kind of come to this sort of realization now. I think with horror films, I love the beginning, the middle, and the end. Like, I need there to be an end. Like, I love the conclusion of a horror film. Like, the build up, the suspense, the adrenaline, all of that sort of cycle that your body and your mind goes through when you're watching a horror film. With a series, you don't really get that because the credits roll, and you've got to like then you've got to wait and watch the next one, and it doesn't round it off the
you
same
have to
way.
Wait for it, at
yeah,
least.
Whereas with a TV show like say Detectorist, or even putting in the past or stuff that I've watched in the past, TV show wise, it's always I want it to keep going. I don't want it to stop. I want it to keep going.
That makes sense.
But with horror films, I like that short ride.
Yeah. Did you watch the recent Cabinet of Curiosities, the anthology?
Yeah, I started watching a couple of them. I did actually. There was the really cool one with the occult table that they found.
Yeah, that's the first one.
Yeah, that's it.
But that's good because they're all. Well, I really enjoyed all of them, I think.
Yeah.
But they're all completely different.
Well,
so
that's
you
it. You get the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Yeah, exactly. So you can just go to any of them.
I always maintain that Stranger Things should have been an anthology series.
Yeah.
Because I do like the new ones, but...
Yes, of course the Stranger Things. How did that one pass me by?
Because I do like the new ones, but it very quickly became... Like, the first series, what was so good about it was, like, that mystery that, like, drove it. It was
real
mystery.
It would be good
mystery.
To sort of, like, have a focus on a different group of kids and their different mystery.
Yeah, but it could all be tied to the same mystery. It's just different people uncovering different aspects of it so that there's always a sort of, like,
Because the other, like, the upside down is everywhere, isn't it? So, like, it doesn't even necessarily have to be
It's the thing in all horror, supernatural horror... is that like when you over explain the antagonist, it very quickly it just like the suspense and the fear is based on the like not knowing, like the creepy enemy that doesn't have a, you know, like that's why Blair Witch is really effective for me, because you never find out.
It's one of the best favorite horror movies, I think.
It's like
Blair
if you watch what's that one with Ethan Hawke,
Face Off. Sorry.
Oh yeah, that one.
The one where the bad guy looks like the guy from Slipknot with the mask.
Oh, phone. Something about phone.
No, not that one. It's older than that. It begins with an S.
He was in another one.
Sinister. It's called. I really enjoy the build up of that film, and then there's a bit sort of I can't remember how far in it is. It's like part, you know, maybe before even the or just at the start of like the third act. Where he like finds some researcher and calls him on Zoom, and he tells him exactly who this bad guy is, and it's like, oh, it's this ancient demon Bagul, and you're just like, and then the whole rest of the film you're like, okay, it's just like, you know who it is then. It's the same with so many of those films.
Yeah, so my thing that I've just watched with a friend last week was She Will, which is a film.
Oh, if we love that movie. Yeah,
which I had not seen.
So good.
We scored that on our folk horror bingo.
Oh, I must have missed that one. me and a friend like to watch like horror films together, so she'll come over and we do tend to talk through them a little bit because we like to drink wine and talk. But it's like, I really enjoyed it because I mean, she's been doing a course about like women in horror, and obviously, like, it's the trope of like the scary old lady in a film, and that totally like flips it. And I wouldn't say that it's scary, but it's definitely like,
it's kind of more like human. It's that whole humans are the real monster scary, because you
it's
wrote
another,
about
it's
it, didn't
thing
you?
We were looking into, that I wrote about for Undefined Boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same guy who did the detective scene.
Like these, there's a thread of recent films that are all written and directed by women, starring women, and very much deal with the idea of trauma. So I wrote about Saint Maud. I wrote about The Power, She Will, and Censor. And they're all very they're all like, it was just the idea, they're all very British.
They're gritty.
Very
British.
Gritty. They all deal with like the harsh realities of Britain, and and all about trauma in some way. Some have happier endings than others. She Will has a kind of there's a, I don't know if you'd say revenge arc to it, but there is
there is definitely a revenge arc in there,
which is
the catharsis of actually dealing with that trauma that she'd just hidden away all of those years.
Yeah, so you can't exactly call it a happy ending, but it's more positive than that not happening, if that makes sense, I suppose.
Yeah,
kind of needed to happen for her as a character. Yeah.
She gets a power from the landscape and from the you know, the trauma of
that's what I liked
past
about it.
You know.
Yeah, the idea of the kind of the witch burning sort of still exists. The kind of the force of those women still existing in the soil, and then they're connecting with the land in that way is so powerful, like on so many levels.
Yeah,
that film
like
the literal
power of the like the mud itself, like she
ashes of these women, like it's super powerful, like
cool film. It's just a cool concept as well.
I thought that was it was a cool film, so so that was my thing.
Definitely.
I'll wrap it up, so thank you so much, that was such a good chat. And
you.
I think it's going to be like literally no editing which is really really good for me,
just editing my stomach grumbles throughout the
So thank you so much, Bunty, and thank you so much, George.
Thank you.
I'll put all your links for everything that you do in the description, so everyone can
check you out. Oh, it was so nice talking to you, and let's just do this
not
on record. Not on record next time.
No, I have to record every time.
Hang out in the library, drink wine, and we can talk through horror movies. It sounds great. Yeah. We've got to score them on the folk horror bingo.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. So, thank you very much.
Would you like one of those to take with you?
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah. Next time you watch a movie, you've got
to
let them know your scores.
Yeah. So, thank you, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, how great was that? George and Bunty covered so much ground, and I could have listened for longer. As always, all the links are in the show notes. Please go and check them out, especially the links to All Things What, and Bunty's art as well, because she's just ridiculously talented. So just before I finish this episode, I wanted to shout out my wonderful friends, Victoria and James Wall, who make short documentaries as Creative Stories. You can find them on Instagram and YouTube. Again, they're linked in the show notes. So they make short films, and they made a short film featuring Bunty last year. Their style is personal and intimate, and I really urge you to go and watch all their films, which focus on local creatives. Again, links are in the show notes. Please check them out. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode next month. Goodbye.